The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Tim Ronayne, the CTO at anyvan.com. Really looking forward to the show, mate, to be honest. I mean, I think mainly because I've the kind of platform that you've been building, I think it's a fascinating model. But as well, you know, just because of your kind of background and experiences as well, it's something a little bit different. I've been talking a lot with data people lately, and that boring bunch, you know, and no offense to anyone who's in data. And I think it's obviously, I think it's there's a lot of poignancy there to the climate that we're in at the moment, why we would do that. But, you know, very much excited to talk with someone like yourself. So, you know, thank you for taking the time. And yeah, I think best way to start, I always like to ask really, and I think a lot of the people and the feedback we get on the show, people really enjoy hearing people's background and stories, because especially for the people who are kind of aspiring to have a career like yours, I think it's always nice to get some kind of context on how you actually got started. So if you can't already tell by the accent, I'm assuming you're not from around here. So how did you kind of start to get involved in tech in your kind of early days?
So I got involved really early, actually. I was a kid in the 80s and I lived in Sydney. And I was quite lucky because my father worked in a university. So unlike most kids, I would imagine, in the 80s, I got access to an Apple II computer, which he brought home. And I got right into that. And, you know, I would spend sunny weekends inside programming a computer, just learning basic, writing little games and things like that. And yeah, my mother would tell me to go out and play, and I would just kind of ignore her and spend hours on it. So I guess it's always been a passion of mine, and that's how I got into programming. But I actually also wanted to be a pilot. So I started an aeronautical engineering degree. And I guess a big change in my life was I saw a job posting at uni for a job at Apple in Australia, just working on their support line. And I thought, that looks interesting. Thankfully, I got the job and I went and started at Apple. And it was back then, there was just like 9 of us on a support line covering the whole of Australia, covering all of Apple's products. But it meant that we had quite a lot of access to all their tech. So if there was a new product, we'd get our hands on it quite early just to play around with it. And it was a bit daunting. Like within the second day, I had a guy calling up with a network of computers I couldn't have even afforded. Asking me for help, and you know, you had to think on your feet because this was something I'd never even looked at before. But just the exposure to that and the fact that the internet was blossoming around then as well, while I was working at a tech company, really made me think I want to get into computing. So I swapped my full-time aeronautical degree for a part-time computer science degree and started working full-time at Apple, and that's how I got into computing. I didn't get into web until the early 2000s, when I'd just gotten to London, and the dot-com crash had just happened and there was not a lot of work. And I had an unemployment phase, and I thought, I'm not going to, you know, waste the time. So I built a website for my flatmates and me to show our friends and family what we were doing back home. And actually, it worked quite well, and I got quite into it. I built like a back end for it and got really into coding for web. I liked the kind of instant gratification from building for web. And I even extended that and made it into a public sort of travel blog. It's called Planet Ranger. It's actually still online, but it's a bit of an antique. It hasn't been maintained in years. But yeah, that's how I got into web, and then I started freelancing in that, and here I am.
So do you ever think, because obviously your internship, if you want to call it, your kind of early experiences and exposure to tech, a lot different than today. Do you ever contemplate, if you'd have got involved in tech now, whether you think it had been a different story? Because I look at it now, and I do find it intimidating, especially if you're going in there from kind of ground zero, just because of the vastness. Do you ever kind of contemplate how different it may have been for you had you not, just had the stuff like basic, which kind of, you know, was a pretty linear path into kind of developing those days. Do you ever perceive that to be, completely different sport almost, isn't it now?
Yeah, I mean, it would be difficult, I imagine, to know where to get started. It's even difficult for me now as a CTO to looking at all the different technologies and frameworks and things available to know which one is a good one to learn and which one's just going to fizzle out. I think that would be quite daunting these days if you were starting out. I guess my advice would be to sort of read up. I mean, there's I think it's called The State of JavaScript. It's released every year, and it kind of tells you who's using what framework and things like that. Those kind of summaries of what people are doing help you to know what to get into. But I agree with you. It would be quite a daunting task just seeing, you know, the many branches of computing and even studying, you know, starting to study and someone just takes you all the way back to zeros and ones. And I guess in the 80s, zeros and ones, there wasn't a long journey from there just to a basic programming language, whereas zeros and ones all the way to artificial intelligence is a very long journey now.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, maybe you get, I think we have more talent now. I think more people getting involved. But I think that's just because of the access to computing that we have now. Whereas, you know, I actually interesting that, you know, you're from Australia, because I can imagine that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was not only difficult in those days to get access to computers, but even more so if you were somewhere quite remote like Australia, where kind of everything sort of imported in itself. So I can imagine it was almost, you were probably quite rare really to be have the access to that kind of computing at that time.
I think I was. I mean, I did have friends who had computers at the time, but I know that, so I know a lot of the people in my school didn't have them at all. And, you know, it was definitely back in the days where you were considered a bit of a nerd if you had a computer. But yeah, the Australia, I mean, it's not such the backwater people think. Like, we did have internet when it kind of started and things like that, but it was, I can imagine being in rural Australia at that time, it would have been very difficult to get into computing. So I definitely do think I'm blessed. I think that, I'm lucky to have had the access that I did.
Do you know the general kind of interest that you had in computing and some of those traits? You know, I'm sure you can identify some that have allowed you to sustain, you know, a full career in technology. Do you think, even though the landscape has changed so much in technology now, that still some of those traits are desirable for an organization now you're on the kind of the end where you're looking to hire people? Do you think that can you still identify a couple of kind of characteristics and traits in individuals that, that have remained consistent even though, you know, technology has evolved so much?
I mean, if I'm talking specifically about programmers, because obviously the world of IT or the world of web has, you know, it involves designers, UX designers, people who don't necessarily have to have the same traits. But if I'm specifically talking about people who write code, there are definitely traits, I think, that you need to have. The fairly simple ones like being analytical, being a good problem solver. You have to have patience, I think, because, I mean, any coder will tell you, you can spend hours trying to figure out a problem and then go to sleep, wake up in the morning, and you've solved it in 2 minutes. But I think for me, when I'm looking for, when I'm recruiting, the biggest thing still is just a passion for it. If I ask someone about what they're interested in, you know, what new technologies, what new languages are coming out, and they can speak to me about it, not just knowledgeably, but, you know, passionately, then I know that they're going to also find their job fulfilling and they're going to be passionate about it.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's true. It's always, I think it's always a similar story. I think, you know, having a general interest and passion for the work that you do, you know, certainly, I just think you're only able to perform at your best if you are generally interested in something. You might be able to force a career, potentially, you know, but you're never going to get to that kind of top level, I don't believe, if you don't generally have a passion for it. I actually wanted to ask someone on that as well, because I had a conversation with a lady this week, and because I posed a question to her about, you know, kind of tech people being this kind of rock stars, and I explained it in the sense that, you know, why we really like rock stars is because they're doing for a living exactly what they want to do, and they're kind of, you know, making money out of their hobby, essentially. And I was saying that this kind of generation now, the developers are the rock stars, because a lot of those people are doing for a living what they would have done probably had they not been able to, you know, to just, you know, to make money out of it. They still would have probably done it on the side, sort of thing. Yeah. And interestingly, like, most people tend to agree with me on that, but she was kind of saying that, and I don't know how I want to take this, you know, I don't know whether I want to agree, disagree, how, what my kind of take is, but I'll pose it to you. But she actually was the first person who kind of opposed that and was saying that, actually, yeah, there's probably some sense in that, but also it's almost like creating kind of a closed community for people who are interested in getting involved in development, for instance, because it's quite intimidating. And she actually had the experience where she started off in university and was kind of going to start her course off in computer science and, you know, dropped out eventually because she kind of got overwhelmed, even though she was actually doing very well, apparently, and got overwhelmed because everyone around her had, like, apparently been coding since they were, you know, 5 years old and stuff like that. And this is kind of the propaganda that seems to be kind of pumped into society. And she thinks that there's an angle where it maybe, like, suits people to keep that going. But she actually felt it was relatively unhealthy to consistently kind of churn that out. So I don't know how I feel, because I do think that, one, yeah, you need, I think you have to be good because it's becoming competitive. You have to have that kind of general interest in it and some level of passion for it. But, you know, I also tend to agree with her that, yeah, like, I've certainly been in those experiences. Maybe it wasn't with computers and stuff, but I've certainly had those experiences in life where I've kind of joined a club or tried to get involved and felt very overwhelmed because everyone's like, oh, I've been doing this for, you know, for years. And that is an intimidating thing to overcome. So I just thought I'd pose a question to someone like yourself who has been doing it for years, and whether you'd ever kind of thought about that, you know, at this kind of climate that we're in.
I'm thinking about it now. It's interesting. It is an interesting analogy about the rock star. I mean, I never thought about the reason, but I guess what you're saying is true, because I think a lot of developers, particularly wealthy ones, are doing exactly what they want to, you know, do with their life and being paid for it. I mean, I guess the other thing, the thing that's different, rock stars tend to be very glamorous and, you know, people, I think people look at rock stars and they want the fame and the popularity, whereas I don't think, maybe fame with some of your, like, Zuckerbergs and things like that, but I guess, I don't know, are developers now seen as popular? I wouldn't have imagined that. But I do see her point that if you're starting late, and now I didn't start late, but I can imagine it would be a little daunting, particularly, I mean, I see it with people who start at Anyvan, and I've got some really talented people in my team. And if you're starting out, even if you're a seasoned developer, you're starting out with a big system that's been built over 9 years, and there are people there that really know what's going on. And even though on paper you look like you've got a lot of experience, it can be difficult when someone reviews your code and turns around and says, actually, you've done this wrong and this wrong. And I mean, hopefully they don't put it that way. They put it in a nice way, but yeah, you can see them that they're a bit like, they feel a bit left out, a bit not part of the clique, if you like. So we have to make an effort just to be, you know, friendly about it and try and make sure people are given all the support they need. And I guess that's something that should be transported to. I definitely don't think you have to start as a child. I think you can start quite late in life. I would wonder if you've never touched a computer, why in this day and age. I mean, never touched is the wrong word. If you've never really written a line of code or kind of gone near it, I would wonder if you really have that interest. But it's not up to me to judge that. I mean, you know, if you're halfway through a degree and you're doing really well, I think that's proving the point that you do have a passion for it.
Right. And I think, you know, it's an interesting point as well, because clearly what you're saying is, you know, even though you have experience as a developer, I think there is always kind of that vulnerability factor there, because you're learning a new system, or, you know, you're learning a new tech is kind of a constant. So yeah, you're always probably going to ask, I think there's no avoiding it. If you choose this as a career, you're going to enter an arena where you feel a bit vulnerable, and you feel like you're miles behind the people who already understand the system. I think that's potentially part of the package now. I'm not sure.
Absolutely. It's a difficult part of being in tech. It's almost exhausting the amount of learning you have to do to keep up. Sometimes I joke, like, I wish I worked in a cafe or in a broom factory or something like that where nothing changes. But, I mean, I guess maybe brooms do now. Maybe they're putting IP addresses in them. I don't know. But, like, it's kind of it's an industry where you can't just go, oh, my degree's done, I can sit back and earn money. You just have to constantly be keeping up. And sometimes you'll see a new technology and you're like, oh, I'm so interested in it, I'm going to learn it in my spare time. Other times it's something that might not interest you that much, but you need to know it, and that can be quite exhausting.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's part of the industry.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's part of the commitment now, isn't it? No question.
Yeah.
I think you have to just enjoy the learning process. I think otherwise it's just a, you know, it's a non-starter really. Now, and you know, it's, I had a gentleman on a podcast a couple of months ago who put it quite well when I was, you know, he was talking about the onboarding, like he was talking about how he was bringing people onto his team, and he was saying, you know, there's a lot of talent out there now, but still, you know, you're constantly getting humbled as a developer. And when I look for people, I don't look for someone who comes in and says, I know everything. And he's like, I come in and I look for people who should come in and say that I can learn anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, I think it's a really, you know, great way of putting it in this climate, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's actually something I find quite difficult when recruiting, is because that is a quality I definitely look for, but it can be quite hard to determine if someone has that ability to learn. Usually I'd kind of look at their history and how, you know, are they just sticking to one thing, or are they changing around, or do they tell me that they're learning something in their spare time? That's the kind of thing that kind of gives me the indicator that, yeah, they'll probably learn something quite quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. I think it's a difficult one, because the kind of the hiring process has become so different over the years, because you start off and it's, do they know how to do this kind of one tech 15 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So it's finding the talent who can just do this one thing. Now it's, you know, you kind of have to build your skills quite broadly. You know, jack of any trades is almost, it's not the right way to put it, jack of all trades, but, you know, but you have to have a much broader skill set. And it almost seems like, you know, from what we see is, the softer skills are almost more important, and softer skills being more important is obviously something that you can identify. But I think with the onboarding process, it's much more difficult to identify in that hiring process. You know, if you're technically, you know, capable, you might have certain certifications or whatever, and that, you know, that would suggest that they're able to do the job. But with the soft skill set that I think is much more in demand now. And, you know, I think in some respects as well, for developers, it's they don't go hand in hand. It's not something that goes hand in hand. You don't have that leadership ability, you know, the great ability to have commercial instincts as well as being really, you know, technical. It's quite a rare combination, but yet it's something that a lot of employers are now kind of seeking out. They want people to be able to put things in plain English much easier.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, I don't want to sort of generalize about developers, but we haven't in the past been known for soft skills. You know, it's generally the stereotypical image of a developer is, you know, a guy with headphones not communicating with anyone, deep in thought all day long, who needs to be treated with kid gloves. And that I think is something that we should try and you know, break out of, because a developer who can communicate and who can see things from the aspect of the user, if you like, or the stakeholders, is one that's going to do much better, I think.
Agreed. So I want to talk a little bit about Anyvan as well. I thought the story was quite interesting when we spoke over the phone, you know, about kind of how you actually joined Anyvan. I know we covered a little bit when you and I spoke earlier, but
yeah,
I was wondering, you know, always compelling, always love a good kind of startup story. How did, what was the story with that? How did you kind of originally get involved?
So I was freelancing way back now in 2009, just doing freelance web development work, which really suited me. I like freelancing a lot. And I was approached by the two founders of Anyvan because I'd done some work for one of them before. And they came to me with their idea for Anyvan, and I immediately wanted to work on it because I looked at it and said, well, this is a big project. It's challenging, and I think it's a good idea. So, they didn't even have an office at the time. We would keep meeting up in various locations in London and kind of specifying what it was we were going to build. And then I think it took about 4 months to 6 months for us to kind of get it ready to launch. I think maybe we built in too many features, but that's, you know, it's in the past now. But yeah, we launched it in September 2009, I think it was. And yeah, it kind of went from there. And I guess with a site or a service like Anyvan, you don't just build it and that's that. The list of features is literally never ends. It just keeps going. You know, the bigger you get, the more you want to add something, the more feedback you get, oh, you should add this, do that. So there was a lot of work still for me to do. And I, at the time, was planning to return to Australia. So the guys sort of approached me and said, we'd prefer it if you didn't. Would you like to sort of become a permanent part of Anyvan? And I looked at it and I saw that, you know, this was something that I'd helped build, and it was becoming a success. And I thought, yeah, I'll stay. So I've put up with the weather but you know, I think it's worth it. It's been a really good experience.
And we were talking as well about even looking back at when you started at Anyvan, you know, just to cover the point as well that we were making earlier about how quickly things have changed. You say you look at some of the work you did in the early days with Anyvan, and you know, it looks ancient now.
it's true. I mean, even just the design, but the design wasn't really responsive because I think the smartphone was, you know, not very prominent at the time. If I look at some of the queries we were using we have fairly complicated search queries that queries we make to the database, because, you know, if we have a transport company going from London to Edinburgh one day and they're coming back empty, we want to try and find a job that matches that route, which is not the most simple query for a database server to do. And back then, I mean, I look at some of the way we were approaching it with trigonometry, which I think just would fall over if it had the load that we have now. But yeah, it's funny, like, I do every so often send a screenshot to my team when they're, you know, when they might be moaning about something on the site, and I go look at what it used to be, because yeah, it really, it's amazing how fast things change in just a decade.
It really is. And you know, building the platform, and well, I suppose building a platform business, should I say, from scratch, no easy task. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's one of those things, isn't it, that from the outside looking in without any thought into it, it seems like a no-brainer. You know, you look at the Uber example or something like that, you know, it's, oh yeah, yeah, why didn't I come up with that idea? You know, you kind of get it all the time. Same kind of thing with any van is. And they're the best ideas, the ones that seem simple, but actually kind of the work behind it is incredibly difficult. So you actually kind of, you know, built it from scratch, essentially, and, you know, then had to make it into kind of a network that was at scale. So
yeah,
explain to me, like, how you even, you know, went about the incredible achievement to have done that.
But, thank you.
You know, how did that actually, how was that process, I suppose?
So, I mean, the problem with building a platform in the beginning, it's sort of like a chicken and the egg scenario, because you need the transport companies to lure in the customers, but you need the customers to lure in the transport companies. So, I mean, that part wasn't really down to me. That was down to Angus and Ben, the founders. And we kind of, I guess we just did a very sort of rapid build up of both transporters and customers, and like a big bang style, and hope that it would kind of grow, if you like, from that. From a tech perspective, it meant that it really had to work. And I know that, you know, that sounds a bit, you know, of course it has to work. But the thing is, if you've only got a small window, a transporter comes onto the site, they're looking for something that's going to bring them, you know, revenue. And if there's no customers or the site doesn't work, they're going to give up very quickly, and it's going to be very hard to get them back. So the tech had to be, we had to have it working, and we had to be able to fix it very quickly if it wasn't. So that was the biggest challenge, I think, in the very beginning. And then, as you say, scale, kind of something that's working in the beginning, as you start to get more and more users, starts to not work, which is, you know, obviously what the problem in scaling is. And so that's always been a challenge for us. Since we moved to AWS in 2015, much less of a challenge. I cannot say how much more sleep I get at night from when we moved to the cloud. But yeah, it isn't as, you know, it's a great idea, something like Anyvan or Uber, but it certainly, it's quite hard to get going.
Yeah. Well, that's it, isn't it? It kind of builds momentum. But I, you know, that's what I always think back to, is those early years, like getting kind of both sides working. Incredibly difficult. Must feel like a completely different situation now, and probably a new set of problems. So with the scale, you know, always new problems, but any more stressful or all about the same?
There are stressful times and non-stressful times, usually when we're trying out a new feature, or we did a bit of a pivot last year. We used to be auction based, or reverse auction based. So the customer would post a job on the site, and then the transport companies would bid on that job, and the customer would choose the best quote, if you like. And we moved to a system whereby we offer a price instantly to the customer, because we found that was what most of the customers wanted the most, was they wanted to know how much it would be straight away. So now we kind of do the auction bit for them. So we just give them a price. So we have to guess what that price is going to be. We have to, you know, guess is the wrong word. Sorry. We calculate what the price should be. And that brought in a whole heap of complexity that we didn't have before. That was quite stressful. But yeah, the stresses that I had in the beginning were much more about scale and having a small team and not enough of us to cover a 24/7 business. These days it's a lot nicer. I mean, I've got a really great sysadmin, so I'm not so much kept awake at night. He's the one kept awake at night. So having good people around me has really helped. But yeah, it's still just the things that pop up that you don't expect, you know, with the things like someone figures out how to work the system, if you like, because, you know, if there's a transport company that's grown too large, for example, or they figured out a way to bypass the site and get in contact with the customer, those kind of things that you don't, they stress you out, and then you get them fixed and then you go back to being happy again.
It's, yeah, I mean, great highs, great lows, I'm sure. And, you know, you talk about building the team around you as well. Obviously, budget probably changed over the years. But, you know, when we spoke, you talked about you had a previous kind of experience with a startup as well. So that budget, kind of building things lean is probably something that you felt quite comfortable with. Do you think that those practices, because I've had experience with that myself, about, you know, building extremely lean and then being involved in an organization where you have to actually start to spend.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's like, it's a good kind of, it's a good experience, it's a good starting block to build lean originally, but do you think it can hinder at times when you get to the point where it's like, right, we've actually got to start spending now?
Yeah, I mean, for example, I think when you start lean, you tend to, you build things like tech debt because you're iterating, changing, making things, and there's a lot of kind of features that just become zombies and it's code that sits there and you don't bother cleaning it up because you don't have time. You're still trying to make the site right and earn more money. And tech debt, as any developer will tell you, is quite a hindrance after a while, and particularly as you get larger, it becomes much more of a hindrance. But starting out lean, it's very difficult to avoid. It's hard to turn around to a founder and say, wait, we need another week to write documentation, or wait, we need another week to just clean up the code a bit. They're like, no, forget that, we'll do it later. So those kind of things can be a hindrance. I'm trying to think of other things. I mean, maybe you get into bad habits like tech debt and, you know, taking shortcuts and things like that, which as you get bigger, you really need to stop doing that and spending money on, you know, having a QA who comes in and tests your things for you, rather than testing it yourself, because obviously that's not a very thorough thing to have a developer testing their own code. They're all standard things that as a company you grow, you should bring in, but it's, yeah, when you start from scratch like that, you don't have those things and you learn to live without them. And sometimes I think you manage to live without them a bit too long.
I think what you were saying though, from a purely technical person's perspective, the good habits that I picked out there were that you are kind of forced to be more commercially aware, because you're kind of understanding the pressures that the founders or the sales guys or whatever are under, and you have to kind of work to those deadlines. So it probably gives you frustration level on some level, because you're like, no, I could do it another week. But at the same time, you probably also are exposed to more of the commercial side of the business, whereas maybe if you've kind of started off in a bigger organization, you might not have had that kind of same exposure. And, you know, obviously now if you want to progress to that kind of leadership position in tech, you almost it's kind of a prerequisite to have had some commercial exposure.
Yeah. I would agree with that. It's interesting sometimes because we're trying now to hire people who've come from larger teams to bring in that kind of experience, the structured experience of a bigger team. And often, you know, they'll kind of be like, oh, wow, you don't do this. And they're like, yeah, it's difficult to explain to someone that, you know, having such a beautiful procedure that produces beautiful code with 100% test coverage just isn't possible when you're starting out. I mean, we started out a long time ago, admittedly, so we're not going through that so much anymore. But yeah, it's it's interesting seeing the different take people have when they come from a larger organization. And you're right that it's something we need to learn on the go. And particularly, you know, for my career, I need to learn on the go if I wanted to move into a big corporation.
It's been really cool talking. We're at about 35 minutes now. I'm trying not to go much more beyond 40, but just to finish off as well, you know, it's been really interesting to get to kind of hear a little bit about your story. Obviously, a lot more to come. Do you are you a person who sets goals in kind of that, I suppose, a formal way? You know, people with experience, I don't know whether you kind of have those same aspirations as, not aspirations is the wrong word, but those same kind of hard targets that you may have had when you're younger. How do you kind of approach goal setting and working towards something now, maybe versus when you were younger?
That's an interesting one. I think when I was younger, I didn't really have big sort of career aspirations. I just wanted to code. I just wanted to do something I enjoyed. And to some extent, that is very much still true today. But working at Anyvan, definitely just, I mean, it's been very nice to have something like this that I can see, you know, that has millions of users that I had such a big part in. It's given me a kind of, it's made me think, is this, it's put me in a position that I didn't think I would be in. And now I think, is this something I want to do, you know, with my life? And it's kind of hard because I'm at Anyvan now for, you know, the foreseeable future. So my goals are very much Anyvan orientated. I look at how we're working and how I want Anyvan technically to look in the future. So, and my personal goals, I think they're much more about outside of work now. I like to, you know, I think about what will make me more happy insofar as, you know, what am I doing outside of work? Do I want to learn new things? I like to keep my hand in the developing a little bit because, you know, there's new technologies I want to be a part of. I think more than looking at career goals, I look at, you know, what technologies do I like? Like I'm quite interested in autonomous vehicles, and I'm thinking there's probably an angle for Anyvan there. So that's something I'm starting to look into quite heavily. I guess I'm not the most focused person in that way, but I kind of ride the wave and point myself in the direction I think I'll enjoy.
I like that though. I think it's great practice. I think people are too harsh with these kind of goals, you know, saying I need to do this by this age, I need to do this, I need to earn that kind of money, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think it's cool to have something, but I actually am, you know, and this is a change of attitude for me, by the way, but it's something I've learned in recent years as well. I think that it helps you kind of stay in the moment a little bit more as well if you kind of avoid these like super high level goals for yourself as well and just enjoy the process. And I think ultimately that's what makes us happy. That's my take anyway.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Tim, it's been a real pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed the chat.
No worries, Annie. It's been a pleasure too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.